You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet,
and story is everything.
We're your hosts, Jim and Bobby Bell.
And we're excited that you're joining us tonight. That was, our opening music, Hot Texas, performed and written by the Hot Texas Swing Band. And we love that music to get our toes tapping and get us started. So, Jim, who are our guests tonight?
We have special guests tonight. We have Peggy Chambers, and she's bringing on a guest, John Tolles.
We have a full house. We welcome back Peggy Chambers. She is joining us for a second time here in our first year on the air, and we just love Peggy. And she kind of comes on as a little bit of a guest host.
She does.
Yeah.
And is.
Yeah. And I know you have so Peggy will say hello first. Hi.
Hi, Peggy.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate this.
We do too.
Tell us where you're calling in from. Where are you?
I'm calling in from Oklahoma, Northwest Oklahoma, the town of Enid. And I always say the home of Vance Air Force Base. And then people go, oh, okay. Now I know where you are. But our guest tonight is John Tolles, who's also from Enid.
Right. And here's John. Hi, John. Yeah. Jim has a little bit of an intro for Peggy, and then Peggy, we're going to have you introduce John. John, we're so excited you're with us.
Okay. Peggy Chambers calls Enid, Oklahoma home. She is an award-winning author of 12 books. She writes in several genres, from children's books, young adult books, adult suspense novels, pulp fiction, and comic books. But she has decided, after much soul searching, to settle on the mystery suspense genre going forward. Maybe. She has two children, 5 grandchildren, and lives with her husband and dog. You can find links to all her books on her website at PeggyLChambers.com. Welcome, Peggy.
Thank you. And it's great to be here.
Peggy, you write a blog. You write a wonderful blog. I think it's every Sunday that
I write a blog every Sunday morning, yes. And a lot of times it's about my books. Other times it's about writing as a whole or, you know, something that happened that week that I needed to get off my chest.
Mm-hmm. And it has a very lovely name. It just makes us want to get in that hammock with you. What's the name of your blog?
It's called Views from the Hammock, and I started off actually writing it from my hammock, which has bit the dust. There's no hammock anymore, but I'm still writing the blog, so.
It's wonderful, and we thank you for the blog entry that you did promoting this show this past Sunday, I think it was.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes, we thank you for that. And we have your special guest, John Tolles, is waiting here. Let's bring him on and welcome him.
All right.
Hi, John.
I'll tell you a little bit about John. First of all, he is the president of the Enid Writers Club, and that's where I met him in my writing club. He's an Episcopal priest who writes mysteries and makes fabulous wine. I know because I've drank some of the Enid Writers Club, and he plans a pilgrimage next year walking the Camino de Santiago, which is a 500-mile hike across northern Spain. He's been a priest in the Episcopal Church since 2005 and is currently serving in the diocese of Oklahoma. The legal jargon at the back of the book states, characters represent any. Please help us in in joining with John Tolles. Okay. This is John.
Yeah, I'm delighted nice to have you here. Thank you very much. You broke up on me there. I don't know if it's me or you, but I got the gist of what you were saying.
And
I'm sorry. That's a, okay.
This, I'm just going to jump in there right now. That can happen sometimes. And one of our screens may freeze for a moment. And what we've learned is just keep going.
Keep going. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So, John, you have three books out. Am I right? Three?
I do. I've got one that's more of a story of a walk of faith, and the other two are mysteries that take place in the church. And all of the ecclesiastical terminology kind of makes you crazy trying to pronounce diocese and remember who's on first. Is it the bishop or the canon to the ordinary or the right reverend or whoever? So,
yes. Having grown up in the Methodist Church, that was all Greek to me. I'm serious. But we did. I really enjoyed it. We talked about the very first one is titled The Golden Fistula. Yes. And this is a copy of the book that Bobby Jean is holding up. Tell us, what is a fistula? Because we don't know.
Well, a fistula is the most sacred and holy straw. And they don't actually use them anymore, at least as far as I'm aware. I'm going to hold up a picture here so that you can see. There's one of the popes using a fistula, and you can see they use it to drink the wine from the chalice so that they won't spill a drop. And it came in fashion for a little while, and then it went out of fashion. But I was studying about it in seminary, and when I was looking at it in seminary and thought about it a little bit later on, I said, well, that would be a great murder weapon.
I don't know if it could ever be used again after that, no matter how much you tried.
I don't know if it's ever been used before, but I sure thought it would be fun.
So tell us a little bit about where you're from originally. You're not from Enid.
No, I grew up in Louisiana, and I went to school in Texas, East Texas, at Stephen F. Austin. And then when I graduated from college, I was bound and determined to be the next Donald Trump. And well, that didn't work out. Probably a good thing. Otherwise, I might be facing jail at this time. But after about 6 years of working in Dallas, I made a move to Montana just because I was young and single and could, and became very involved in the church there. And the next thing I know, they were shipping me off to seminary, and I spent 3 years in seminary in Wisconsin. That Wisconsin, very near where the fictional cathedral is in both of those books. And then I went back to Montana, and I served in, I started off with three small parishes, and then I had five small parishes after about a decade of serving there. And then I got tired of being cold, and so I moved back. Came back down, got a little bit closer to family.
That's good. That's good. You said you were kind of a circuit rider for a while there.
I was.
Which one do you want to use to listen to this?
I got, it's my phone. Sorry. Ask that again. Okay, I'm sorry.
Oh, I just said you said you were kind of a circuit rider for a while there.
I was a circuit rider in Montana when those five churches, I did about 20,000 miles a year driving between those churches. It come rain, come sun. The postman and I were always the two that were out there at least because we would travel in any kind of way.
I can't imagine. So what got you started writing?
I actually started writing soon after college. I didn't do much writing before college, but soon after college, when I had my first apartment, I always read a lot. I do a lot of reading. And one day I just said, you know what? I'd like to try my hand at this. And so I sat down and would write probably kind of off the wall short stories. I was reading the Paris Review at the time and trying to be like the ones that I read in that. And then one day I tried something a little bit longer and it just sort of went from there. Yeah.
Well, that's good. That's great. So you decided to write after you wrote the one that was had to do with a faith journey. You decided to write mysteries, which are totally different.
They're completely different. You know, I wrote The Journey, which is the story of faith. And then I also at the same time wrote one called Spring Hill. And that is the current project that I'm working on. And we can talk about that a little bit later. But I didn't really know what I was doing in writing something of that length. And I have no idea what to do with commas. There, and there apparently were problems for me at the time because I couldn't figure out which one was supposed to be spelling. But it was a start. And then I ended up in Montana. I continued to write a little bit. When I went to seminary, I was writing, well, it wasn't fiction, I'll tell you that.
And well, you said you write constantly. You're always writing a sermon or you're writing your book. Or something.
There's always the sermon is always out there. I write two sermons a week that I put up on the blog that are available for people to read. But I'm always writing something. Yes. Mm-hmm.
How much research goes into these two novels? Seems like there's an awful lot of background, a lot of history.
There's some history. Most of it is fictional. I mean, the idea of the fistula, the idea in the first chapter of the Marble Finger, where a soldier is headed north into Italy. I did some research on that to make sure that I was tracking the right regiment and all of those types of things, but it was fictional from there. As far as the history of the church and the players in the church, that's, you know, after being in it for 20 years, it's second nature to me. I know what those are. So I have to try to be careful to explain what a reverend canon is or a reverend doctor or whatever it might be so that the readers outside of the church might be able to understand it.
I enjoyed your characters in the first one. Well, they're in both of them, but Father Anthony and the detective, they're polar opposites. And
yes, they are.
And they're friends. Well, maybe not originally.
There's a detective, Thomas Stavlo, is the detective in the book. And I have a very good friend, John Stavlo. And he's a federal agent. And so Thomas Stavlo is kind of based off of this character of John. And he and I are... we are very opposites, but we are great friends. He's this big, burly guy that scares the daylights out of you when he walks into the room. And but we hit it off from day one, and we've been friends for over a decade now. And so that character is based off of someone.
That's good.
Yeah.
I noticed that you have a dog in there. There's a dog. What's his name? Tell us about your dog.
His official name, he died, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. His official name was Ezekiel's Mystical Dream. And it got shortened down to Zeke Boy or Z-Man or whatever. And he was just dumber than a bag of hammers. He was the most brilliant dog when it came to being around children. He had this great sense of when it was okay to be stupid and when it was okay just to sort of to sit there and be at peace, because he was a magnet for children. They would just see this big white fluffy dog with these fluffy ears, and they would sit there and fluff his ears and talk to me about all sorts of things. So the dog in the story, it is basically the dog that I had. He did plenty of the things in the book that are in real life that I talked about in the book. But he was a delightful creature, but he was not smart at all.
there's a description. He's a French poodle, and you have Tony in italics. So we know we're getting some little moment of humor. Say, well, he was something like, well, you knew he was French. He spent so much time smelling the flowers, sniffing the flowers, smelling the flowers.
Yeah, he would walk around and smell flowers. And when I was in Montana, he stuck his tongue out on a metal pole when it was 26 below and got his tongue stuck to the pole. And he was that smart. He really was. But he was a delight.
Oh.
Well, he redeemed himself a little bit. At least in the book I read, The Marble Finger, at the end, he was a big help. So,
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked a little bit earlier about the humor that you bring to this. Now, this is a murder mystery, so there's nothing humorous about murder. But you do manage to poke some fun. And it was a lot of fun to listen to. I mean, we talked about the fact that you poked fun at the politics of the church.
Yes.
And yet the man was very devout. It was obvious. And it's an interesting combination, the way you put it. Well, here, we just disappeared. But I'm assuming we are. Where do you keep on going?
Just keep talking, Peggy. We got you.
The character of Father
Bobby
Anthony
Jean, should we start on the Marble Finger, or should we do that after?
Well, let's see. What time? Let me see. Well, we're at 7:16 or 8:16. We could take a break right here, and we will hear a little bit about the Out West Bookshop. When we come back, we'll talk about the Marble Finger.
Sounds good.
Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shops Bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
And
welcome back.
We're
on the with the writer, special guest Peggy Chambers and John Tolles.
At the moment, Peggy's not on the screen. We assume maybe she'll click back in. We are delighted to have you with us, John. We were talking right before the break about, of course, we've been talking about your two wonderful mysteries, The Golden Fistula and The Marble Finger, and we each read one of them. Jim, you read The Marble Finger, and
that's
you
right.
had a question about Hemingway.
Well, yeah, we got a little reference to Hemingway in there. Of course, it goes back to 1929, about, I guess, when he's a war correspondent in Spain. And around this time, he writes the only play he ever wrote, which was a flop, but called The Fifth Column, perhaps?
The Fifth Column, yes, it was.
Yeah. And you wove that kind of that story into your story here in the Marble Finger.
That's what I was. I had wanted to reference the Fifth Column, Hemingway's version of it, a little bit more, but I got to a point where I was like a little bit concerned about the copyright issues and all of that type of thing, and trying to get permissions for Hemingway. I said, "Well, you're never going to get that, John." So. I moved on from there, but I did like the idea of the fifth column, that sort of those within who were seeking to change the course of history, despite those the rest of those who were actually supposedly in. So I have a copy of it around here somewhere. It was not an easy book to find, actually, but it was fun to work with.
And Peggy is back. Hello, Peggy.
I don't know what happened. I kept asking questions.
It's okay. It's okay. This is that internet world. We're in, we're out, we're back, we're here.
We're talking about The Marble Finger, and we just talked a little bit about the Hemingway reference, so it's all yours, Peggy.
Yeah.
Okay. I haven't read The Fifth Column. I think we talked about that a little bit once, John, and I don't have a copy. Maybe I can borrow yours if you find it.
Uh-huh. It's on the shelf somewhere.
Hemingway's dead, so what's he going to do? You know, I think there are some Hemingway families member's still around, but anyway.
Yeah.
We talked about the marble finger, and I don't know for sure what all we discussed, but it's a continuation of this first book, but it's really not. It's a totally different story.
It's a totally different story with some of the main characters still playing out. When I was writing The Golden Fistula, I started having an idea for the second one. So I wove in a little bit of pieces here and there, the statue of Mary and those types of things, so that it wouldn't be something brand new in the book, so that it would sort of build off of a little bit of the history was there, the courtyard where the statue is and all that sort of thing. I started weaving that into the first book so that when I sat down with the second one, I'd have a little bit of the foundation already at least talked about, maybe not built, but talked about.
Having been a secretary, I loved the secretary in the book. she kept everybody in line and told Father Anthony he needed to clean up his act on a regular basis. She was good.
Well, I've had a number of people tell me that I can kill off just about any one of my characters, but if I try to kill off Miss Avery, I'm going to be in big trouble.
So. she was good. And, you know, they had just barely gotten over one murder when suddenly we had a second murder. So,
yeah.
And I like the fact that there's some underground catacombs or so, something to this church. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure your church actually has those, but...
You know, most older Episcopal churches, they've been added on to 4 and 5 times. And there's hallways that it can be remarkable at times. And there are some churches that have these little passageways and secret staircases. And they're brilliant. And if you don't know they're there, you'll never find them. So
that was certainly true in the first book. Jim and I were both remarking on that, and you as the writer take us through those hallways and you help us understand, because this one makes a slamming noise and this one is very narrow and this one has a bloody handprint, this one, this and that, and you kind of are trying to get through that maze with the characters and some of the kids know what some of those spots are, and you can imagine that some of the youth enjoy hanging out somewhere where they think nobody will know they're there.
Right. Yeah. And they would.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because there are a lot of the phrases that I didn't understand that had to do with the Episcopal Church. And so I had my phone out and I'm Googling, you know, trying to figure out where I am, what we're doing. But it was interesting to see, and both of your books have a prologue. Can you tell us about that?
I would just like to sort of try to give a hint as to where the book is going to go without giving it away completely. And so it just isn't, I don't know if it's a, what would you call it? I don't know if it's a gimmick or if it's a formula or however you want to phrase it. But I always like to have this idea of starting off with this image of something that you don't, that's not going to resolve itself until you work your way through the story.
Mm-hmm. Well, the prologues take place quite a few years prior.
Yes.
And they give you a history of what's about to take place.
Yes.
So you
and
said
I've
you
got
have.
I've got the third Father Anthony one in my head, and it's going to go back about 100 years. It's the title of it, or the working title of it is, King Solomon Had Many Wives.
Ah.
Oh, wow.
Can we be advanced readers?
Yeah.
It's still up here, though. I haven't put it on paper yet, but I'm going to.
That's an interesting promise.
Yeah.
I like that.
So that's number three, but you still have another work in progress. Did we want to talk about Spring Hill, or did we want to wait till after a break for that?
Whatever you like.
Okay. Spring Hill is totally different. And tell us, when did you start writing that?
I started writing Spring Hill probably around 1991.
Mm-hmm.
It was... someone asked me where the original idea came from, and I really have no remembrance of where it came from, other than the fact that I had just read The Bridges of Madison County. It was all popular back then.
I remember.
And there was something about a story within a story, there was a current story, the current year, and then they went back in time, history, with a few clues to tell a story within that story. And I liked that idea. I liked the way that worked. And so when I decided that I wanted to try and write something larger than just a short story, I ran with that idea of a story within a story. And Spring Hill is actually the town that I grew up in Louisiana. In the book, it's probably nothing at all like the town is today, or maybe not, it maybe never was, but it's how I remember it as a child growing up and my impressions of it. And what I thought it, as I think about it today, or thought about it when I started writing it a while back, what I thought it was like. And it's really, really just impressions, not the actual town, but I like the name Spring Hill, so I ran with it.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it is a story. I've read this one too. It's a story within a story, like you said. A man goes back to a town, and things are different, but he makes a big impression on the people there, and it makes a big impression on him as well. And people change.
And it's a character-driven story as opposed to a plot-driven story. It probably falls more in the category of literary fiction than you know, anything like mystery or science fiction or something like that. So it's more about people and their lives.
Mm-hmm.
I'm enjoying working on it, though. So,
do you have any prospects yet?
No, not yet. I'm still. I sent it off to one and heard back a no on it. But I almost fully expected. I wanted to hear a yes. We always want to hear a yes, but probably a bit premature in sending it off. But I did. So I'm working on it now and going to do some more edits and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've self-published, which I think self-publishing is great. But this one I would like to try. I would like to try to get it through with a publisher and all of that. So I'm doing a little more work on the editing side and sort of the planning, that I hate to say it, but the business side of writing as well.
Well, there is a business side to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
My business is failing, but anyway.
Mine is too. I'm not very good at it.
You're good at it. I had a question. Now I've totally lost it. We do have a question that we will ask towards the end, but with the Spring Hill, you have quite an unusual group of characters. What brings them together? Do you think it's just a town, or what is it that they're varied?
What brings them together? Well, the bulk of the story, of the current day story, takes place within the pharmacy.
Yes.
Which is kind of a soda fountain, one of the old fashioned soda fountain, where the pharmacy, where the soda fountain was there and everybody would stop and have an ice cream and that sort of thing. But what binds them together is the history and the memory of a young couple that was growing up just about the close of World War II and their lives. And everyone sort of revolves around, at least those in the story, sort of revolve around that couple and what took place during that time. I don't want to spoil it. Well, not like anybody's going to remember. There is someone who gets murdered in it, but it's not a murder mystery. But it is part of the story, and it's part of the history of. I mean, it's a small town, and so a murder in a small town with people who are sort of big in the community, it lingers, and it becomes a part of the mythology almost of that community. So it's the development of that in the early stages.
Peggy, shall we take our next break? Let's go ahead and take our next break. Yeah. And when we come back, we'll talk more with John and Peggy about the writing process. Stay tuned. Okay. We'll be right back.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer with special guests, Peggy Chambers. Hi. John Tolles. Don't mean to laugh there, but...
Whoa. I don't know who's disappearing, if it's me or somebody else.
That's all right. Peggy's back. You're back.
Okay.
We're talking about, with John, we're talking about his book he's working on now, Spring Hill, and it just sounds so interesting. If I can, Peggy, I just want to jump in with a very quick question. John, you were saying that this is a little bit more character-driven, so... Do you already know that all the characters in a book, or do new characters make themselves known to you as you're writing? Mm. Do they come and whisper and say, "I need to be in this story"? Do they refuse to do what you want them to do? Do they say, "Uh-uh, dude, I'm not doing that. You don't have me correctly." Tell us a little bit about just how you interact with your characters.
When I sit down to write, I have with a project, I'll have an outline of that project, but it's going to be maybe one or two handwritten sheets with lines and arrows pointing and scratch out and things like that, and that's my outline for a story. And from there, I sort of start off into it. I have an idea of what they're going to do, but for the most part, I never know what they're going to say. I never know how things are going to resolve themselves. I just sort of let them loose in my head and let them start playing around up there. They sort of go to work.
It's okay.
Yeah. It kind of sounds like you need to be locked away when you say that. But it's an opportunity to really just have this freedom to, because you know each one of the characters, they have to have their own voice, or everybody sounds alike. I mean, it's just a monotone story and a monotone. I mean, they're all generic, and so each one has to have their own voice. And so Miss Avery in the mysteries, she's got to have that sort of firm hand, I'm in charge whether you think you are or not sort of thing. Father Anthony kind of has to have his snark, but he's a man of faith, and so he's got to be able to rein in some of the snarkiness that which is natural to his heart. And he's a lot more like I am than I really should admit, and hopefully my bishop isn't watching this or I may not have a job after.
We talked.
Go ahead.
No, finish up. That's right.
I really do like to see what they're going to do, especially, and I love to write dialogue. And when the dialogue begins to happen, I almost can't type it fast enough because it's just they're just going.
Yeah.
And it's a fun time. It's a fun place to be there and do that.
Do you write straight into your computer? Or you do an old style handwritten?
I type straight in. The first draft is completely typed, and then it comes off, and I scratch it up and mark it up and make my changes that way. And then I'll type all those back in, and then I'll do that process again. I'll probably write and rewrite about 5 times before it's ready to be sent out to readers and those types.
You have somebody proofread or kind of look it over and say, well, this doesn't make any sense to
or
me,
the writing
John.
Group, use the writing group.
I sent it out to the Golden Fistula. Only sent out to a couple people, but the Marble Finger I sent out to a dozen people and got feedback from all of them. And they came back and said, yeah, what? You know, those types of things. They were really good at also, you know, on some of the ecclesiastical jargon, helping me say, you know what, that nobody's going to know what you're talking about there.
Yeah.
And so I was able to find those spots and explain it a little bit further. And then hopefully somebody knows what to do with commas, because that's I mean, things like that.
That's where Grammarly comes in.
You know, that's the best I can do. So
yes,
yeah.
Hope for the best.
We talked a little earlier about the fact that you make wine, and you do make really excellent wine, because I've drank it. So the question here is, how is wine production and story creation related? Do you see them as being equal?
Yeah, that's a good question.
It really, I think they pretty much go hand in hand. To sit down and to make wine, you have to have the ingredients, the various parts, and then you have to mix them. You have to allow them to ferment. You have to allow Chardonnay. You might have oak, you know, oak chips or something like that in. And these flavors and these characters have to blend together in order to create a finished product. And there's sort of that fast and furious fermentation process that takes place in the beginning. And then you kind of have to let it sit and just be together and just settle out all of the bits and pieces, the yeast and all that has to settle out to clarify the wine. And so it's very much, I think both the process, winemaking and writing go hand in hand. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think they do.
Are you a chef also?
I love to cook. I do. If you saw me, you'd say you love to cook too much.
We made a lot of comments in the Marble Finger about the roommate to Father Anthony, and he's always cooking up some sort of delicious meal.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I know. I love to cook. I'm trying to think. Oh, I made manicotti earlier this week for some friends, and it was good.
It was good.
I love manicotti.
Are you a Stephen King fan by chance?
Oh my gosh, I got more Stephen King than I got sent. Cy King. He's known as Cy King in the Dark Tower series. The Dark Tower series, and I always refer to him as Cy King. I've read, I won't tell you how many times I've read The Stand, but I will tell you that I'm reading it right now. So.
I wonder because you make at least in the book I read, there's references to Stephen King, and I thought, well, either he really likes Stephen King, at least I think Father Tony likes Stephen King.
I think we both do. Yeah,
yeah.
I'm just a big fan. I think he's developed a lot of his early stuff, you know, with the Carrie and the Shining, the true horror stuff, but. His later things are really about the characters and the development of those characters, and they're just brilliant. So, I'm a Stephen King fan.
I am too. John comes to our critique group every now and then with something new, and I said recently he was channeling his inner Poe because his short story was The Spider in the Coffin, and I haven't got to finish it yet, but I'm looking forward to seeing some more pages, so... It's creepy.
That was my first attempt at horror, so okay.
We have a question that we always ask. Or are you going to do that for us, Bobby?
No, Miss Peggy, you go right ahead with
charge.
That. Go ahead with that question.
Has been a question since the beginning of this show when it was called The Writer's Block and now Rendezvous with the Writer, but what do you, as a writer, do when you get writer's block?
Aha. Well, like I say, I have different types of writing. I have my sermon writing, and regardless if I have writer's block on that one or not, I still got to write a sermon. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to that, it's a matter of Well, I, you know, the Stephen King quote that I have around here somewhere to the effect of amateurs sit around and wait for inspiration while the rest of us just go to work. And so when it comes to a sermon, sometimes I just have to go to work and write that out. And it might, you know, you can't knock it out of the park every week when you're doing that type of writing, but you do your best. And most of the time, if you've done the basics and the foundation of it, then you're all right. When it comes to this other type of writing, I've never actually thought about writer's block, but probably I have been experiencing it for the last month or so, because I'm finding it very difficult to sit down and write. I pull it up on the screen and it's just like, well, I don't want to do that. And I get up and go off and do something else. So I think it's really going to have to be, I think that the same principle when it comes to writing sermons is going to have to apply to this, because actually this week, Friday and Saturday are my days off. And this week I said, Friday, you're going to sit down and write. I don't care if you feel like it or not. This is what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. And so I think sometimes it's just a matter of, you know, putting one foot in front of the other and just going. Mm-hmm. And it might be slow, but at least you're going.
Peggy, what about you? How would you answer that question for yourself these days? I don't know. Peggy, did you hear me? I don't know.
I think a lot the same, in as much as you can't edit work, you have, if it's bad, you can go back and edit legend and do work on another story. Sometimes that helps. Mm-hmm. But my writer's group has been really great. I will put things out there. Did she do this or that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I'm just going to keep on assuming that I'm on. I would just continue to write something and then I'll go back probably and say, that was crap. That was really bad.
Hey, John, how long does it take to write the average sermon, if there's such a thing as an average sermon?
I start working on it on Monday. I'll sit down and start reading my text and getting ideas. And then generally on Thursdays, I'll sit down and write. And it's probably 4 to 5 hours to write one.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's an all-day job.
John, do you have a favorite place you like to write? I'm wondering if it's in the very room we see you in right now.
This is where I love to sit and write. It's a place, it's normally darker than this in here, and the only thing that's lit is like the surface of the desk. I keep the curtains pulled and all that, and I don't turn on any music or anything like that. I might turn on white noise or something along those lines, but I just sit here in my dark little cave and let people play around in my head. So,
do you have a tip for a new writer or a struggling writer?
Go for it. Absolutely go for it. You can say, I don't have any talent. I'm not any good. I don't have a story to tell. If you want to sit down and write, sit down and write. You would be amazed at the things that that you can do. People sit down and they say it all the time. I just don't know how you do it. I just don't know how you do it. You know what? There's a book in all of us, and there's a writer in all of us. We all have these brilliant stories to tell, and we just need to tell them.
Mm-hmm. Jim has pulled two quotes from the first book that we'd love to share with our audience. I'm just looking at the clock and I know our time is going to fast come to an end. Jim, what did you find that was quote worthy?
Here are two observations made by Father Tony in the book, The Golden Fistula. She, this referring to the lady we talked about before, Miss Avery, was also constantly reminding me how wonderful the previous curate was. I hope to one day reach such a status, but I have yet to turn water into wine and have long since given up any attempt to walk it on water. It's kind of funny, huh?
Yeah, and here's the second one. Here's the second one we found.
They don't teach this in seminary. They don't teach how to balance a church budget, how to balance your life, how to fix the boiler, all of which you are expected to know how to do when you arrive in a parish. They also don't teach you how to cope with the murder of your superior.
Indeed. And there was never a single class on that in seminary.
Yeah. John, where can people find you, follow you, get your books and such?
You can find a couple of the books on bookshop.org. I think you all have a link on the Rendezvous with a Writer website.
Yeah.
They're also available on Amazon, if you'd like to go there and get them. And then there's a blog, and you can follow my blog, which is johnftolls.com. And that's where I have a lot of writings. I do photography and pictures. The sermons and those types of things are available there on the blog.
And, of course, the two books that we've been talking about tonight, well, we've talked about four books, actually, this evening, but the two mysteries, The Golden Fistula and The Marble Finger, and Jim and I both enjoyed reading these. Really, really, really fun, good mysteries, twists and turns, unexpected things. We were both surprised by the villain. Neither one of us guessed who that person was. And here's Peggy again. Peggy.
Good to see you back, Peggy.
I'm so glad. Peggy, where can people follow you and find your books and find your blog and such?
Well, like John said, they're available on your website. They're available at on Bookshop. They're also available on PeggyLChambers.com and Amazon, and those are good places to look for them.
We are so happy that you were both with us tonight, and it's so fun, Peggy, because tonight kind of ends our very first full year of Rendezvous with a Writer, and we had you with us twice, and that was just so delightful, and we'll need to look at this with you again in 2024.
Great.
Next Thursday, we kick off kind of our second year, and I'm just going to take a quick moment to just review. August 31st, we have author Gene Cooney with us. It's a murder, don't you know? So we have a murder mystery next month. On the 24th, we have Gold Digger by Kathleen Morris. This is the legendary Nellie Cashman. We're so excited to meet both of these authors for a first time. On the 17th, Paris Afton Bonds joins us. She was a regular also on the Writer's Block, and we're so excited to have Paris back with her newest book. And another author that was with us every time she had a new book is Kathleen M. Rogers, and we'll be talking about The Flying Cutterbucks on August 10th. And then to kick off our second year, it is the first Thursday in August. And so because it's a Thursday, Henry Park, film editor of True West Magazine, will be with us. And we will have our guest is Manuela Schneider. Manuela is an award-winning Western history, fiction, mystery a writer, and also translating for Wolfpack Publishing some books from English into German, I believe. She's actually going to be joining us from Germany, 3 o'clock in the morning, her time on Friday morning. She's often comes to the States, but she will be back in Germany. We're very excited to have a chance to get to meet Manuela Schneider. And we just thank you all for being with us tonight, whether you were live with us or you're picking this up as a podcast or in the archive. John and Peggy, thank you, thank you, thank you for
thank
being
you.
With us.
Thank you.
And?
But we always say it's always a great day out west.
See you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.